This is Christian Bohr with the Park City Chamber Bureau. Joining the Chamber Bureau is a great investment for your business. Chamber Bureau members enjoy a wide array of benefits, including instant credibility, weekly newsletters with relevant information, educational seminars, webinars, and much more. Information on joining is online at visitparkcity.com or call us at 649-6100. The Park City Chamber Bureau is a nonprofit organization and a proud supporter of KPCW.
Hi, this is Catherine Simos, Vice President and Branch Manager at Grand Valley Bank, Frontier Branch, and Park City, a proud supporter of KPCW. Our team can help you with all of your banking needs, from checking and savings accounts to business lending. We have Heber Valley Bank in Midway and Heber, and Grand Valley Bank, Frontier Branch, and Park City. GrandValleyBank.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
And welcome to the Sundance Reel. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Today, my co-host, Linda Jager. Thanks for joining us, Linda.
Morning, Leslie. Happy Sundance.
Yeah. Now, you've been out of town. We had talked to you last week. You were with your team, U.S. Biathlon team, kind of cruising New York, but back now for the rest of the festival. Huh?
I am back, yes. Unfortunately, had to miss the opening weekend for some media opportunities in New York, but I'm back, and I have a few documentaries under my belt, and that's usually where I gravitate towards in each festival. This is my 14th year going to Sundance. So I started out with To Be Takei, about George Takei the other day, which was great. I love it. And do you follow him online?
Yeah, I see his photos now and then, yeah.
So it was really fun to kind of get behind the scenes. And he's just multidimensional. I mean, just so many great things and such a great advocate, and was really fascinating to learn more about him.
And a delightful person.
Yeah.
Just listening to the couple of clips that Rick had edited from his Q&A, mm-hmm. He just sounds like a fun guy. Now, was he at the screening that you
He was not at the screening. I was hoping he would be. It was a morning screening, so he was not there. But still, it was great to be part of it and see it. And the audience reaction, a lot of laughs, and everyone was really positive. So I think it'll do well.
All right. And what else have you been able to see then?
Yesterday, I saw Whitey Bulger's the documentary about Whitey Bulger in Boston, and I think it's the United States versus Whitey, and it was good. It was long. It was a little long, and I think the challenge with that movie was they didn't have cameras in the courtroom, so a lot of the activity they were talking about in dialogue in the courtroom was done through voiceover and courtroom sketches. So in this day and age where we're used to seeing that happen live, I think that was a little bit of an adjustment for the film, but it was interesting. I grew up in that area, and it was interesting to hear about what was going on and some of the corruption theories and so forth. So it was interesting.
Yeah. So this is Joe Berlinger's latest. Did you walk away thinking that the government was complicit in all of this?
It didn't bode well for them. It was. It definitely raised some suspicions there. And it is a CNN film, so I'm sure it's something that we'll see coming out on CNN as well. They've been doing quite a few documentaries lately. So definitely interesting. And if you like crime stories, you'll really enjoy this. It's riveting in that way.
Yeah. Well, the one that I really liked yesterday, and we had talked with them earlier in the week, was The Battered Bastards of Baseball.
Oh, tell me about it.
It was not that I'm a huge baseball fan or anything, but I like fun people. And Bing Russell sounded like he was a really fun person.
Uh-huh.
So it was about him starting this independent minor league baseball team, mm-hmm. in Portland, where they had left because they just didn't have the crowd showing up to the games. And he put together just a scruffy bunch of baseball players who did really, really well. So well that they threatened the National Baseball Association that 5 years after five seasons, they were paid off to leave. But in the meantime, they had a ton of fun. Kurt Russell actually mm-hmm. playing for the team a little
Great.
Bit. They had so many sweeps of games that they literally had Jagarza that came out with a broom and would like light it on fire after he would sweep off, so it was just a bunch of fun. He had record crowds at the stadium.
I was going to ask. I'm sure that was very well received there.
And then rules changed after that. I mean, basically you have to participate in that league, you have to be affiliated now with a major league team. And mm-hmm. at that point he wasn't, so anything went. And mm-hmm. Like I say, Bing Russell, everybody that talked about him talked so wonderfully about him. And I just thought, he must have been just a great, great person. So
that sounds like a fun one.
That was a fun one. Yeah.
What else have you seen that you love?
Well, Ken Tran and I were talking earlier about the film God Help the Girl, which
yeah,
was
that's
an
on my
interesting
list.
One. Mm-hmm. With and he explained it to me, thank goodness, for people who know what they're talking about. Just that the soundtrack had come out a few years ago, and the filmmaker actually wanted to write it around this soundtrack. And I thought he did a great job mm-hmm. with it. Another great documentary, and I just... because I liked the way that it was put together, was The Case Against Eight. And again, mm-hmm. they couldn't go into the courtroom, mm-hmm. but they showed kind of the transcripts, and they actually had the people reading the transcript.
That's a good effect.
So just the way that it followed, you know, we've often heard from the folks at Sundance that the documentaries, you know, they're either issue-oriented or character-oriented. Mm-hmm. And that's what it comes down to for me. If you like the character in them, you like the film mm-hmm. because they're interesting. And in this case, there were some great characters to watch. So.
Did you learn anything new about the whole Prop 8 situation
well, yeah,
from the film?
Especially after talking with the filmmakers mm-hmm. yesterday, just about how it may be that we have to do this in every state. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, again, Utah now in the appeals process and eventually maybe making it to the Supreme Court like we saw with Prop 8, you know, in California. So as, you know, there as amendments and constitutional changes are found unconstitutional in the states that have banned same-sex marriage, I mean, it may just be a never-ending process here. So.
Interesting, interesting. Yeah. How about Whiplash? Have you seen that yet?
No, but I hope to today. So.
Okay, my daughter loved it, so I'm anxious to hear how you like it.
All right, well, let's bring in our first guest. Great. We'll be back right after this.
Every woman is unique. That's why Park City Specialty Clinics, OBGYNs, take a personal approach to the care they offer women of all ages, from adolescence through advanced maturity. Obstetrics, gynecology, and breast health are among many services they offer. The website is parkcityspecialty.org. Intermountain Healthcare is a nonprofit organization.
Looking to jazz up your Sunday evenings? Well, listen to the Utah Jazz 180 with me, Mitch Echo, every Sunday at 6:06 after NPR News for the latest Utah jazz news and information.
Welcome back. This is the Sundance Reel. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, the Sundance Institute, along with support from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation yesterday, announced a new project that will harness the power of independent film to create a global conversation about extreme hunger and poverty. In the studio to tell us more about that is Joe Beyer. He is the Sundance Institute's Director of Digital Initiative. Good morning to you, Joe.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
So, who came to whom here? I know that the Gates Foundation, of course, they have a project in the works, you know, to eliminate hunger and poverty. What did the Institute then approach them saying, we can help you?
No. It actually, you know, we have the great advantage of attracting organizations like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And I think that they were very curious about whether or not a creative approach to these challenges might be something that they'd be interested in. And so they came to talk to us. We've had a long-term relationship with them. This isn't the first project that we've done. And they were curious if we would be interested in helping them commission, you know, these five short films to tackle exploring these issues of poverty and hunger, but more importantly, to maybe explore some of the solutions that are being put into play. I think that, you know, when you say the words poverty and hunger, there are connotations with that immediately pop into your head, and they're not always positive. And in truth, there have been a great number of positive changes and advancements that are happening in the world. And I think they were looking at this project as a way to maybe celebrate those people that are on a daily basis really tackling these issues. And so they asked us if we'd be interested. Of course, we were. And then working with our two main development programs, feature film and documentary, we found five astonishingly creative and talented filmmakers that took this on. So I think you saw our screening yesterday at the Holiday Cinema, and it went great. We had a packed house, and it was the first time the filmmakers had actually seen each other's work. So they had no idea how the other artists had approached this challenge, and that was really interesting. I think they were nervous and then very excited when they saw the program.
Yeah. So these five films are meant to be an inspiration to some of the entries, correct? And so the new entries coming in?
Yeah. So we began the project by saying we would do five films and present them here at the festival. And honestly, based on the quality of the work that came back, the Gates Foundation came to us and said, we're excited about this. What else can we do? And so we brainstormed about that and then decided what would be really interesting would be doing a global call for entries where everyday storytellers, people that maybe are not professional artists, could also contribute. And so we came up with the idea that we would like to find five more films from anyone in the world that we're going to fly in next year at the 2015 Film Festival. I can't even believe I'm thinking or talking about that at this point. But we're going to do that, and they're going to come back and show that work. And we're going to also bring in somebody that comes up with just a story idea. So it was important to us to find a way that anyone in the world could participate, even if they don't, for example, own a video camera or have any experience with filmmaking. And so we have on our Tongle.com page, which is the platform that's supporting our submissions. It's Tongle.com/Sundance for a shameless plug. But you can submit a 500-character story idea, and that can be a suggestion of a subject, somebody maybe down the street that you think is an interesting person with a story that's related to this project, or a place, or you can write a mini narrative. It's about two tweets worth of information, so you have to be concise, but we're going to find a Sundance filmmaker to take an idea and make a film out of that. That's and, yeah, we'll bring them here next year, so...
Yeah, so the one we saw like yesterday, the Master Chef. I mean, was it a real story, or was it a documentary, or did they actually just kind of hire these young kids to act this out, this idea?
Yeah, no, the Master Chef is a great example of the creative approach to this challenge. That was actually a fictional short film. That filmmaker also has a feature, believe it or not, in the festival called The Lunchbox. And so that was a creative approach to this subject matter. And I think it was very powerful. I hope you enjoyed it. I know the audience did as well. And so we also had an animated or short that incorporated a lot of animation in it as well. And the Global Short Film Challenge has no creative limits. And that was really important to both Sundance and Gates, that this is not, we're not asking people to hit a very specific set of circumstances with this contest and this global call. We're giving people the opportunity to really approach it from any angle. And, you know, I one of the interesting things, I would love to see if somebody could perhaps approach this subject with humor. I know that sounds totally unorthodox, but it might be very interesting, for example. So that's sort of what we're hoping for.
Yeah, well, MasterChef had a little bit of that.
Yeah, it sure did. Right. Yeah.
Do you see this becoming an annual event?
Oh, I'd love that. That'd be great. You know, it's very rare, I think, in our industry that we get a chance to do pure good. To be, you know, I don't want to suggest that we're changing the world with this project, but I think that it could be a spark for really interesting conversations, and more importantly, for people to take a moment in their busy day to realize that there are so many people in this world that live in circumstances that are so much more difficult than we can imagine, and creating empathy for that other experience is an important part of the project. So I would be thrilled if we could do this again, yeah.
Yeah, so will the Gates Foundation money then go to filmmakers to produce the film once they're kind of selected?
Exactly. Through their generosity, these filmmakers will not only be able to come to the 2015 Film Festival, but the ones that we select out of this contest will receive a $10,000 prize. So that's wonderful.
All right, so it's not like they have to use the 10 grand to make the film.
No, it's an honorarium of sorts for the effort, but certainly they could put that money to use on the short film too.
Although you mentioned the one that submits the idea, that's what you'll take from start to finish as well.
Yeah, our partner in this is the platform I mentioned, Tongle.com, and they were so enthusiastic about working on this that they actually have volunteered to underwrite flying out the storyteller. That wasn't an original part of what we conceived, but they're generously going to take that expense on because they were really pumped.
That's great. I think it's a nice application.
Okay. Again, people can find out more by going to the Sundance webpage or the Tongle.
Right now, we just launched yesterday, and the best place to go is tongle.com/Sundance.
That's T-O-N-G-A-L.
That's right.
And you can see the five shorts there.
We're going to premiere those online very shortly. Yeah, we're rolling them out, and then we're also doing four more Sundance alumni films over the course of the year. So there's going to be a lot of content. So,
great.
Yeah, keep a lookout for it.
We'll look forward to seeing them next year, too.
Thank you so much.
Joe, thanks for coming in.
Winter is in full swing at the Utah Olympic Park. The park is open daily from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Explore the Alf Ingen Ski Museum and the Eccles 2002 Olympic Winter Games Museum. Take a guided Olympic heritage tour or watch athletes train while enjoying a hot beverage from the Silver Bean Cafe. Info and rates are available online at UtahOlympicLegacy.com. Parking and admission is free. Utah Olympic Park is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing sport and recreation opportunities.
The Glitter Tent at Stein Erickson Lodge is a proud supporter of KPCW. The Glitter Tent restaurant offers regional American cuisine with Chef Zane Holmquist seasonal menus. Located mid-mountain at Deer Valley Resort, the Glitter Tent serves breakfast, lunch, and dinner daily. Sunday brunch with live music. Reservations recommended. 645-6455.
Welcome back to the Sundance Reel. I'm Leslie Thatch, along with my co-host today, Linda Jager. This is the Sundance Reel, and in the studio with us now, the director of the film Watchers of the Sky. This is one of the films in the U.S. documentary competition. It's Edith Belzberg. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you for having me here.
Very welcome. So begin just by telling us, well, an unusual name first. Tell me about your name.
Oh, my name. It's a Hebrew name. It's a biblical name. It has various meanings.
Wonderful. So tell us about Watchers of the Sky. I mean, what's it about?
Watchers of the Sky, it starts with the story of Raphael Lemkin, who was this incredible man who coined the word genocide and also pushed through the United Nations one of the first ever human rights laws. And he did this not representing a country, an organization. He was impoverished. He barely spoke English. But he was able at that time, he was a refugee himself. His whole family had been killed during the war. But he was still able to bring all the nations, all the countries at that time together to pass this convention that was his hope would stop massive atrocities.
How did you discover Raphael's story and how did it inspire you to make your film?
I read Samantha's book, Samantha Power's book, mm-hmm. A Problem from Hell. And the first three chapters are about Raphael Lemkin. And I just remember being on my couch and reading and I put the book down. I said, I have to do something. You know, it was an immediate reaction of, I have to do something. And, it was the first, maybe 60 pages, and I knew immediately I had to do something. And then I continued to read the book, and my desire only grew. And then I contacted Samantha, the author, and then that's how it all happened.
And Samantha is one of the four humanitarians you profile.
She is.
Did you select the folks to profile?
So it's interesting. So at the time, the Darfur crisis was at its height. Mm-hmm. Every journalist I knew, every filmmaker I knew was doing something and was traveling to Darfur. I had tried numerous times to get a visa. I was denied repeatedly. Then I tried to get the United Nations was going on a mission. I received a letter of request that I accompany them. I received also a letter from the African Union, and I received a letter from the European Union. Each time I was denied a visa. And so I spoke with someone at the African Union, and they said, come here, in Addis Ababa in Ethiopia, and we'll take you, we'll walk with you to the Sudanese embassy. I was there, and after 2 weeks, it was clear I wasn't getting a visa. Mm-hmm. But as I was there, there were negotiations that were going on between the members of the Sudanese government and also the rebel groups. And I met someone from the rebel group, and he said, well, come to the liberated territory in Darfur. If you meet us in Chad, we can take you – we'll cross the border. We'll take you across the border. I said, okay. And so I vetted him, of course. And then I went to Chad preparing to go into Darfur. I took a very small crew with me, my producer, Carrie Proper, and also cinematographer, Jerry Recius. And while I was there, it was the soldiers were – the majority of them were children, you know, mm-hmm. as young as 13 years old. And I was very taken by this. And some were very much older, men in their 50s who would complain about their backs hurting when they were driving on the truck, you know. And but the kids really very young. And it was and so I befriended a number of them, and one of them really captured me. And at that moment, I had a choice of whether to cross the border and go into Darfur and be with the rebels as they really are battling the government, or to follow this young soldier and to meet his family in one of the refugee camps. And I decided to meet the family of the young soldier. And so that I went to Eastern Chad to the refugee camps there. And when I was there, you know, Chad is a very – these places are obviously very difficult. And for the aid workers, it's incredibly difficult. You know, they're surrounded by violence. There's sometimes not enough food or water. And they have to work in these circumstances and take care of, you know, tens of thousands of people. And there was one man who, you know, from 7 a.m. to midnight was – unwavering in his you know energy and his persistence, and also going above and beyond his UN mandate, which was unbelievable. And he his eyes just envelop you. And when I sat down and asked him his background, he said he was a survivor of the Rwandan genocide. He lost his entire family, and mm-hmm. he felt that, you know, every day he has to do for others what he couldn't do for his own family. And so then he became a watcher in the film, as we, and then of course there's, and then I started following Luis Moreno Ocampo, who is the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court. And as I was following him, as he was addressing the Security Council, I met Benjamin Ferenz, who was the chief, one of the chief prosecutors in Nuremberg, and also knew Raphael Lemkin. So everything everything came full circle.
So these stories of these people kind of intertwine then with Raphael's
yes.
story?
Yes.
Hmm. So this Raphael, I mean, when you say that he coined the word genocide, I mean, I guess I just – that's been happening for so long. I mean, for eons, but it's just interesting yeah. to me that it's just this – or last century, I think, that the term was even coined?
Yeah. No, I mean, it's been around so long, and the crimes have been around so long, we just assume – as Samantha has said in the film, we just assume that the – word has been around so long, mm-hmm. but it wasn't. And he, you know, he went through many in 1933, even before World War II, you know, broke out. He was trying to come up with a word for this crime. He had been studying this since his youth, and even in college, and became a lawyer because he wanted to stop masses of atrocities. And he was constantly looking for a word. He felt if there was a word that really, really captured the weight of the crime, that he really believed that that would be enough to stop it. Mm-hmm. And after the war, and after he lost his family, you know, he went through barbarity. And in the film, we show, you know, really struggling to come up with the right word. And then he comes up with the word genocide, which is half Latin, half Greek, genos and side. And he believed at the time, if he could find the right word, that he could really, it would bind humanity in some way.
And so does your film try to answer that questions? I mean, given the fact that it's a planet full of humans, we continue to do these atrocities yeah. to one another. I mean, does the film explain why? I mean, is it just a matter of power, corruption, greed? I mean, what is it?
What the film does is it shows that we know these crimes are going to happen over and over and over again. What is our responsibility is to figure out how to if not stop, then impede. We have the knowledge. So now the knowledge, now we have the responsibility of what to do. And that was Lumpkin's point. What we know this, so now let's do something. It's like, if you know you might get sick in the winter, you're going to take a flu shot, you know. And he was trying really to find the mechanisms to put in place to stop this. And so the film really goes into what was our responsibility, what has been done, and what can be done. And what the characters show is what's possible. And that's what the film does. Lemkin showed what was possible, and the other characters in the film today who continue his legacy show also what's possible, what one person is capable of. And if one person is capable of what Lemkin did and what the other characters in the story are doing, then our institutions are capable of and must do much more.
Yeah. So they don't lose hope, huh? These humanitarians.
They don't, and I think that's what's remarkable. I mean, Ben Ferenz is 94 years old today. He's as active today as he was in his youth. He's at the UN constantly lobbying delegates to live up to their responsibility. And as is Samantha, as we know, is our UN ambassador now, and Luis Manuel Campo, who's now really focusing on education. And so they don't give up. And I think that's one of the most important messages in the film.
Watchers of the Sky, it was described as a lyrical film by the Sundance programmer. What do you think the programmer means by that?
Well, you know, something that was important to Lemkin, you know, is, you know, he really felt that we had, that humanity was worth saving, you know, and he felt that, you know, the beauty and the creation that we are capable of is what we have to reminded of, and also that each person is capable of this, and each person must be, you know, saved, basically, if their life is in jeopardy. And so something that was important to me was to show, really to capture the beauty of every day. And he, you know, the way he wrote in his journals was just incredibly beautiful. You know, how he described his childhood and how he described the trees and the birds and his connection and the people. And so it was important for me to bring that out visually as well, through animation. And so one way we tell his story is through animation. And then that led me also, every place that we went to, we filmed with the knowing that we were going to incorporate the animation. So it was really looking for ways to interweave all these stories together. So I think that, you know, the lyricism comes from the animation and then how we choose to weave the stories together using that.
Hmm. So you've had HBO, you've worked with HBO
yes.
before. Is this another
films, yes.
HBO?
We don't know yet. It would be an honor, of course. I've loved, you know, my last two films were at HBO, and so we'll see. We'll see.
Great. Has this inspired you to do more work on focusing on humanitarians? And
well, you know, it's inspired, of course, and it's, you know, we want to get this film out. Our mm-hmm. focus right now is to get this film into every school, into universities, and we have this incredible website, watchersofthesky.com. So I encourage everybody to come to visit our website. And it's we really believe that, you know, that people can be inspired by this film, and that most importantly, the next generation should have the opportunity to really see these amazing people.
Yeah, so it's watchersofthesky.com?
Watchersofthesky.com.
Okay. Great. Well, Edith, thanks so
much for spending
some time with us this morning.
Thank you.
Again, her film, Watchers of the Sky.
Can I tell when it's playing?
Yes. Yes.
It's going to be Thursday night at the Redstone Theater at 10 p.m. and Friday night at Salt Lake City Broadway Theater at 6:45. So please come.
All right. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks. Good luck.
Thank you. Again, it's one of those in the U.S. documentary competition. KPCW News Time now, 9:34.
Hi, I'm Dr. Lisa Saturnino. I'm excited to announce a new Intermountain InstaCare right here in Park City. We provide access to urgent care without having to leave the area. Instead of waiting in line, call us at 435-649-7705. Intermountain Healthcare is a nonprofit organization.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
It's 9:36, and this is the Sundance Hill. I'm Leslie Thatcher, along with Linda Jager. Well, launched in 1997, the Electric Daisy Carnival was first held in Los Angeles. Like Burning Man, it's become a global phenomenon, and all documented in the film Under the Electric Sky. In the studio are the directors of the film, screening in the Midnight category. I have Dan Cutforth and Jane Lipsett. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So this had to be a really fun film.
It was.
I haven't seen it, but I just...
It definitely is. It's not... it's so hard to walk in here and follow someone who's talking about a documentary about Darfur because, you know, our movie is definitely... It's a fun sort of celebration of life. The culture of dance music is blowing up at the moment, but our movie is really about the fans and the people who go on a journey to sort of... a journey to EDC.
How did you discover the EDC?
We directed the Katy Perry movie, and after that happened, we were trying to figure out what we wanted to do next, and we were looking into EDM because electronic dance music, because it was certainly gaining more and more popularity, and it just seemed like a really interesting world. And simultaneously, Pasquale Rotella, who created EDC, had seen the Katy Perry movie and actually, very kindly sought us out because he felt like that our storytelling would coincide with his goal. So.
Yeah,
that's how
I
it happened.
Grew up in Southern California. I mean, I haven't been there for 30 years or more, but I've never even heard of this. I mean, from friends. Where was it in L.A.?
It was at the Coliseum.
Originally, yeah.
Okay. It was originally at the Coliseum, and it moved to Las Vegas a few years back.
2 years, I think. 2 years, was that
two,
right?
Two, 3 years ago, yeah. I think, something like that.
So it's an indoor?
No, it's a huge... I mean, it's hard to... Hopefully the movie does a good job of showing the spectacle that's involved, but it's at a giant speedway outside in the desert outside of Las Vegas where, you know, when everyone's there, cell phones don't work. It's a whole kind of, I heard someone talking about Burning Man earlier. It's sort of reminiscent of that a little bit, but there are 7 stages. The largest stage takes about 80,000 people. There are something like 140,000 people that come every night.
345,000 for the whole festival. Yeah.
So it's an enormous event, and it takes place all through the night over 3 nights.
So do people stay and camp there, or they kind of come and go?
They come and go. There is no camping there, actually. They go back to Vegas or hotels and sort of in the area right around
there.
Yeah,
you would die if you tried to camp there. It's so hot. People go to hotels, or they get RVs, or they just crash with, that's part of the adventure for some people is that they don't know where they're going to stay. They literally show up with enough money, with their ticket and enough money for food, and then then the rest of it is part of the adventure.
Yeah. So, I mean, is it just a kind of a visual and oral delight, or does the film actually tell some story?
No, it definitely tells. It is a visual and oral delight. It's in 3D, and the music is, we paid particular attention to the music, but it definitely is a story-driven film. And it follows 5 different stories from, a young girl from Texas with social anxiety to a group called the Wolf Pack, which are a bunch of male buddies from Massachusetts who have suffered a loss, who are coming to heal themselves. I mean, there's a whole, a married couple, a couple who've been together 15 years who are coming to get married at EDC. So it's a very, it's definitely a journey that you're following and you're invested in these characters.
How did you find the characters to profile? That sounds like interesting
stories.
Yeah,
we did a lot of outreach through social media. There are a lot of websites and blogs that cater to the crowd that are into EDM. So we put the word out there, and it got out there pretty quickly. And we had an enormous number of stories to kind of churn through and work through. And we ended up picking 21 stories, and some of those stories had 6 or 7 characters attached to them. And we tried to follow all of them as much as we could over the weekend. We had cameras that we were almost like a news operation. We were kind of following stories, sending out cameras. And we ended up focusing, as Jane said, on just a few of them, the ones that had the most sort of interesting story and who felt like they had the most kind of life-changing experience through the weekend.
Yeah. So you had some elements to deal with. I mean, kind of like the heat and the desert.
And the noise. I mean, it's incredibly loud. And it was sort of hilarious because we had all this space age equipment, 3D cameras on a massive sort of techno jib that can do all these things. And it requires 5 people to operate it. And no one could hear anything on radio because we were so close to the stage, even with noise canceling headphones. So literally, we were writing on whiteboards and showing it, holding it up and showing it to people so that they knew what shot we wanted. That was literally how we communicated. It was sort of Stone Age communication with space age technology. But yeah, it was pretty challenging conditions, and it was really hot and really loud, but it was really energizing and exciting as well.
Now, these performance type filming situations aren't new to you. You've been involved in the Justin Bieber movie and Katy Perry, as you said before. How is this different from your production, your producing involvement to directing?
I don't know. They're all different stories. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, we just get, you know, obviously the logistics change for each and every movie. But, I mean, I think it's more where, you know, the change that we feel is more connected to the actual story we're telling. Like Justin, we were on tour with him. We were moving around constantly for about, you know, 10 days. And then, and obviously we worked with John Chu on that, who was the director in that case. And then on Katy, we were, you know, we weren't on tour with her for, you know, we shot a lot of the stuff when we got back to LA, but we were using other people's footage and as well, and so that was a different directing experience. And then this, you know, was sort of, you know, from beginning to end, you know, in terms of being shooting. And
it was definitely scary for us not to have a big star to follow and to know that we had that to fall back on. So we were really depending on these stories to pan out. You know, that was the whole approach. Otherwise, you're left with, you know, a movie. There's definitely an audience for a concert movie with a bunch of the biggest DJs in the world. And so we knew we had that. But we really wanted to kind of transcend the concert film genre and make something that was really kind of broad mainstream entertainment, but with great storytelling. And fortunately for us, we got really some great stories. And, you know, it's very exciting for us to be here at Sundance screening it. We've obviously been working on this movie so hard, and we screened it for friends and family and stuff. But to see the reaction that we got on Saturday night, with people in tears, people cheering, it was amazing.
Huh. So when does this thing, carnival, happen?
It happens in June. But there are EDCs all over the country and all over the world now. There was one in London last year for the first time. But the kind of the flagship is the Las Vegas one. That's the biggest. It's the one that every kind of raver dreams of going to. And people come from all over the world. Even if there's an EDC on their doorstep, they'll travel thousands and thousands of miles to go to this one.
Yeah. So a ticket is like for the 3 days. It's not like you just go in for a day at a time.
Yeah. And you get a special box with the, you know, bracelets and the tags. And, you know, so it's a special experience.
Huh. And so have you been to the one in London? You sound like you're British.
I haven't. No, I haven't. I would love to go, but I didn't go to it. We went to one other one in Chicago, which was really fun. That was the first time. Last year was the first time they'd been in Chicago. But again, it was in no way on the scale and scope of the event in Las Vegas. And the other thing that kind of is what is so great as a filmmaker being there that we didn't mention is that people put a huge amount of effort into their appearance. So they plan their outfits for all 3 days. And one day they'll be superheroes. Next day they'll be wolves. And, you know, they wear kind of completely insane outfits. Saw some kind of pretty amazing things that I'll never forget over those 3 nights.
Yeah. So it's a lot of wardrobe, but we don't have to pay for it.
Exactly.
A lot of great wardrobe.
It's a lot of production value that we didn't have to pay for.
Of the audience you profiled, was it a first time for anyone?
Yes, it was.
Like?
Yeah. Well, Jane mentioned in passing this girl, Sadie, who's from Texas. She lives in a small town where everyone listens to country music and Christian music and Little Wayne, as she says. And she had never been to EDC before. She was just old enough to go this year, so she went for the first time. But she's a sort of misfit in her small town in Texas, and she knew that this would be a place where people like her would be there in their thousands. And she had an amazing experience. She suffers from anxiety attacks, and she so she kind of had a mini anxiety attack on the last day, but she rallied and ended up having, you know, incredible sort of climactic experience on the last night.
Yeah. So it's, I mean, people come for the music, but there's so much more going on.
Oh,
right?
Well, yeah, for sure.
Actually, the event sells out before they announce the name of one DJ. I mean, it's such a big cultural phenomenon for this crowd that they don't even care who's playing. They want to be there. They know that the DJs will be amazing, the music will be amazing, but it's, you know, there's art and carnival rides, and it's just a sort of feast for the senses.
I mean, they have a sort of slogan, if you will, which is peace, love, unity, respect, which is all about the experience that you have there, where everyone comes together and celebrates as one, and you know, you can forget all your problems and be accepted. It's really about acceptance, and that's a big message of the festival and the movie.
But they have like carnival rides too, right?
Yeah. They do. Yes.
It's about acceptance and carnival rides.
Right.
And great music.
Yeah.
And great music, exactly.
Well, I got to ask before I let you go, you guys also have a television production company, and you guys produce Project Runway, really?
We did.
Was this your idea for the show, or you just produced it?
Well, I mean, it started, we actually did Project Greenlight before that, which was the last time we were here shooting. And and then out of that, because we were working with Miramax, they had an idea to do a fashion show with models, so we developed the show with Miramax and Heidi Klum, but when it went to Lifetime, we stopped doing that. But we do Top Chef. We just did Time of Death for Showtime, and
Cold Justice
on TNT. So we have the Braxtons. We have we span a wide scope of television. So
yeah,
we
really
love
do.
It. Yeah.
So what are you working on next?
Well, all kinds of stuff. And a new season of Cold Justice, where we literally solve crimes and, you know, in small towns, which is really cool. We've
had two confessions in the last week. I mean, these are all cases that we pull up. So that's premiering. That just premiered Friday night at 8 on TNT.
Yeah, we're doing more Top Chef, more Braxtons, more Tamar and Vince. You know, basically, we got a lot on our plate right now.
Sounds
so we've got to get back to LA today.
Yes.
Well, Under the Sky, again, it's part of the midnight screenings at Sundance. Best of luck to you. It sounds like a fabulous film. I hope I get to see it.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
As producer and directors Dan Cutforth and Jane Lipset, it's 9:47.
Executive Chef Chris Sheehan from Park Meadows Country Club here, supporting KPCW. We offer regionally inspired cuisine such as pine nut crusted filet of sole for dining inside or outside. Our dining venues are also ready for any occasion, and golf, social, and dining memberships are also available. 649-2460 or on the web at parkmeadowscc.com.
Sundance Grill. I'm Leslie Thatcher, along with Linda Jager. Well, what is a country's gross national happiness, and how do you measure it? In the film Happiness, director Thomas Balmes takes us to the last frontier of no media to find out. He joins us now in the studio. Good morning, Thomas.
Good morning.
So the name of the film, Happiness, it's in the World Documentary Competition. Maybe you can describe it a lot better than I just did.
Okay. Well, in 1998... the King of Bhutan just legalized television and internet for the very first time, in the same time that he would stop being the king and just like bring up democracy to the country. And little by little, the whole country just like got connected. Unlike a few villages, and I decided to do a film about one of the last village of Bhutan called Laya, which is at standing at 4,000 meters high, close to the Tibetan border, where 900 people live. And until very recently, you had to walk 2 days to reach the place. They had no roads, no electricity, no connection to the outside world. And I've been waiting with them until this last month for them to be connected and being able, like the rest of the country, to watch TV.
What type of changes did you notice immediately?
Well, the film stops, in fact, when they just turn on the button and start watching TV. So we don't follow really the effect. That I think we all know a little bit the effect of television, I hope. But it's more about, you know, I had like two choices. I wanted to do a film about television, and for a while I was thinking of doing it in America, where people are watching like the longest rates of television in the world. And then I felt it was maybe more interesting to go in a place where there was no TV and just like see the expectations and the willing to watch TV and just let the people think. So it's I'm trying to do more open films where people are busy working a little bit also. I'm not trying to bring them so obviously to what they should think. I think television is one of the less studied issue by filmmakers, maybe because we are funded most of the time by television. When everybody is like busy dealing with ecological issues or like any kind of issues like that, which are obvious, when I think that television is very, very unusually questioned, and I think it's one of the most damaging potential thing ever in terms of like impacting on the life of people and especially the young generations. I myself have three kids. We don't have television, and I'm regularly questioned about why can't we have television. And this film is a little bit a kind of answer I try to do for them.
Now, you focused on an 8-year-old boy telling the story. How did you find him?
Well, I just arrived in the village trying to find a main character. The more it goes, the more I'm really trying. I'm doing the kind of opposite work of a journalist, you know, trying to have an... If I want to do something on TV, I just don't want to come up with my preconceived ideas and trying to have reality filling up in... and to fill up my ideas and just like illustrate these ideas. What I'm trying to do is find a very simple human story, and through this human story I have just a few glimpses of the concerns or the subjects coming up on the background. So to do that you need to have a very strong character and something very visual too. And this young boy was, when I met him, full of energy. He was, in the same time, happy, sad, very moving, and his life and his brain was full of different things. I felt a little bit like watching Jean-Pierre Léaud from The 400 Blows from Jean-Pierre Truffaut, from François Truffaut. You know, have you seen this film from the 60s, a French film? A kind of boy where I was never being bored watching him doing whatever. So it was like... very obvious and very quickly a choice for me as a main character. And then when you have your character and you have your background story of TV potentially arriving, you just go there over months and months and years, which is what I'm doing, you know. I've done the same thing previously in another documentary called Babies, where I've been following like four babies all over the world, also in the different kind of relationship they had with technology, from no technology at all in Africa to a hyper-technological environment in Japan. And this film is a little bit the sequel, you know. It's a kind of like dealing with the same issue of like potential impact of technology on people's lives.
Are you thinking of going back and seeing as it's been implemented? It is one of the happiest places on Earth, correct?
Right. There's some study that measured happening in Bhutan was Bhutan. Like one of them. I don't know what they asked people, but...
Well, at least it's a big concern. They really have a minister of happiness and someone who is really dealing with all these issues. And they are like... really, really concerned about any ecological issues and all that. So, I mean, they're thinking about it. Now, in terms of reality, I'm not sure. I'm not sure if it's like marketing things or whatever. I'm more thinking that Nordic, Scandinavian countries in Europe are maybe dealing in a better way in terms of like equality in between men and women, in terms of education, in terms of health system and all that. I think most of the Nordic countries might be the happiest place in the world. But at least they're really concerned about all these issues, and even the impact of television is really studied and analyzed by some politicians, and they realize that like having from one day to another the whole generation of kids watching 12 hours, if not more, of American wrestling match on television, which is what they do, might not be of the best effect on the society.
Now, you mentioned your kids. Has this movie helped explain to them your decision not to have a television? Have you seen it?
Well, my kids watched the film for the premiere of the film in Amsterdam a few weeks ago in the Netherlands. And at the end of the film, you have like the film ends by the people for the very first time watching TV. And there's like very long shots of the faces of these people who had never seen anything like that and look like zombie almost, you know, like they're mesmerized. And my daughter was 10 years old, told me, do we look the same when we watch a film? And I told her exactly, you know, this is exactly how you look. And since then, she's trying to change her attitude once in a while when we watch something on a big screen. We don't have television, but I'm really keen on images and documentaries and fictions and all that. I'm really concerned about like how TV evolved in the last 10 years with all this reality TV and all these things which are like, I think, potentially really destroying the capacity of the kids to just concentrate, you know, the pace of everything which is being produced nowadays, even fiction or documentaries or whatever TV program, is so quick that this is affecting their ability to just concentrate on anything else, which doesn't have the same pace. You know, my parents are both teachers, and they could see over the last 20 years the capacity of the students just shrinking in the same way the pace of the images which are edited on all these TV programs shrunk. You know, when I was younger, I was watching TV, you had like maybe 10 seconds cut in a program. Now it's like sometimes less than a second. It's a few frames, you know. And when you're like having people watching things over and over for such long time, this is just changing their brain capacity to concentrate on a sentence that someone might tell them later on. And this is very unusually studied and analyzed when I think this is amazingly dangerous.
Yeah. Well, there's certainly the choice, though, not to let your children watch TV. But in terms of technology, I mean, really, there's no going back. I mean, at least here, every kid has a computer, and that's how homework is turned in, and that's how grades are checked, and that's where reading assignments come from. So,
But at least what I find amazing is like how little education on all this technology is being provided to them in school. You know, they should be talked about what is news, how it is made, and how what it means to edit two cuts together, what is related TV. I mean, they should be educated to all this new media, and I don't think there are that much. It's so new, and it took so much space in people's lives that I think politicians who are doing like educational programs don't realize that in the same way that they should learn mathematics and French or American language or whatever, they should also be educated to media and to all that. And the addiction to all these screens, and it's not only television, as you say here, it's like everything. It's like a smartphone and all that. I think it's super scary. It's just like, I think it's too late to get back, but at least there should be some thinking about it.
So I noticed that it's a world documentary. You're French, but yeah. What's the Finland connection?
Well, Finland is one of the co-producers only. It's like a big international cooperation with PBS, ITVS, BBC. I mean, we have like 15 countries, Japanese, like all over the world. And Finland is one of the main partner. I'm working a lot with Nordic countries who are very in advance in terms of like feature documentary production.
Yeah, and for us here in America, I mean, the place that we're going to see it is on PBS,
exactly.
On television.
It's going to be on independent lens.
Sure.
Yeah, my idea is not to ban television. It's just, I think, in the same way, no one would ever think of like having anyone teaching their kids in school, coming out of the street, okay, come and be the teacher, you know? You have some kind of degree, you have some kind of education, you have some kind of qualification to be having that much space in your kid's life. Who has kind of the slightest qualification to produce content for television all over the world? And this kind of lack of content of like who is producing the content which are going to take so much space compared to the school in all this head of the kids all over the world might be questionable, I think. I always feel like the kind of like way we are going lower and lower in terms of content is problematic for many countries.
All right. Well, Happiness, when's your next screening?
Today, 3 p.m., Egyptian Theater.
Okay.
Great.
Well, pleasure to meet you. And it's Thomas Balmé?
Balmes.
Balmes. Pleasure to meet you and good
luck
with the film.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longrimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com. Brett Stimson, Mortgage Assistant for Home Purchases, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Thanks for joining us, Linda. And I guess in the next 20 seconds here, what are you hoping to go see in the next couple days?
I'm inspired to see a couple that we talked about today. It's going to be a busy afternoon, so
okay.
I'll get out to see those today.
Okay. Well, thanks for joining us this morning. That's Linda Jager. I'm Leslie Thatcher. This has been the Sundance Reel. Stay tuned. Coming up, we've got music. First news from NPR. This is Community Radio, KPCW Park City. Sundance Reel only in Park City, only on KPCW. It's 10 o'clock.